Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Dominic. We're reunited, aren't we?
Yeah, you've been away. I've been working, but you've been away.
Have you been working? Very hard.
Of course, very hard.
Nose to the grindstone.
Yeah, but you have been gallivanting around.
Oh, I haven't been gallivanting around. I've been in Scotland.
Right.
So I went up to my Scottish estate, which I have to say, obviously, is not an estate. It's a very small 1820s house.
Right.
But I had to do DIY.
No, really? Were you doing the DIY?
I wasn't really doing the DIY because I've got a friend who is a lecturer in Old English.
You astound me, Tom.
And his speciality is the evolution of Old English to Middle English.
Okay.
So what happens to English after the Norman Conquest? And he teaches it at York University. Mm-hmm. And he has a lovely house there, which is a railwayman's cottage. And it's a Victorian.
Yeah.
And it's the most beautiful house I've ever been to. He is an incredible, incredible designer. So he's done this house up, which was derelict when he got it. And it's simultaneously perfectly in accord with the 19th century vibe. Mm. I mean, there's nothing that isn't 19th century, but also completely cutting edge.
It's a steampunk.
It's not even that. It's more beautiful than that.
Right.
He is the Ruskin that Ruskin wanted to be.
Wow.
So I asked him, would he basically give us an age-appropriate kitchen in the Scottish estate? And so he was up there doing that.
You basically got your friend to build you a kitchen.
He's brilliant, and he wants to combine this with his teaching. So I'm partly mentioning this because I know that people talking about their kitchens is so boring, but he's done it. We've got a butler's sink. He got Sadie to source loads of Delft tiles.
Right.
So we have this massive box full of 17th, 18th century Delft tiles. Just gorgeous.
Wow.
And he's done it all up and it's incredible. And I'm partly mentioning it because I'm still so in love with it, but I'm also mentioning it because if anyone out there
wants a kitchen...
Well, not just a kitchen. I mean, if you've got an old house that is full of, you know, I don't know, 1980s kitchens and you want something different, something age appropriate, he is the man. So I'll just give you his name. He's George Young. And you can find him on Instagram. It's George_Young. And that is Young with an E.
Okay.
So highly, highly recommended.
Crikey.
So bless him. Big shout out to him.
It's very unusual for us to be promoting somebody other than ourselves.
I know, but I'm so in love with it. In fact, I might even put some photos up on the Discord.
Okay.
And Dominic, the other thing that we did, having done that, we then got the train from Berwick all the way up to Thurso on the northernmost northeastern tip of Scotland, and then got a ferry over to Orkney, where I'd always wanted to go. Have you been to Orkney?
Never been north of Fife, Tom. So
you'd love it. It's full of standing stones.
I like a standing stone. I don't mind a standing stone. I just don't like Stonehenge, but I like other standing stones.
So we got up very, very early one morning. There were rainbows, there were spectacular clouds, sun coming, and these stones are stunning.
Mm.
Scarra Brae.
Yeah.
The oldest fitted furniture. So kitchens have been a theme of the break. So you can still see the kitchen in situ. It's all made of stone.
The Scarra Brae. That's where Simon Sharma started his TV History of Britain.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So it's about 4,500 years old, and it was buried beneath a sand dune. Then it got exposed in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And you can see this kind of fitted kitchen. So we had a wonderful time.
Tom, a question for you about Orkney.
Yeah.
So in my mind, Orkney is a sort of halfway house between Scotland and Norway.
Very good.
You know, it's sort of very Nordic. Does that genuinely reflect its...
It did have a very Nordic vibe. I mean, so I... it was a weird thing. I hadn't really got a good book on the history of Orkney. So I read the Orkney sagas when I was up there.
Oh, yeah.
Which describe how Orkney and Caithness, which is the top bit of Scotland and various islands, were ruled by the Earl of Orkney, who was a Norse figure.
Mm-hmm.
Very kind of, you know, Norse epic kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I didn't really know much that happened after it. And then I got a message from a friend who said, did you know that Peter Marshall, the great historian of the Reformation, that he was in Kirkwall, the kind of the main town in Orkney, giving a talk about this new history of Orkney that had come up that evening.
Wow.
So Sadie and I went. He gave a brilliant talk. I bought the book and it's called Storm's Edge. It's brilliant. It's the best book of history I've read so far this year.
Wow.
Amazing. And it's essentially, it's looking at the history of the Reformation, of the civil wars, of the construction of the United Kingdom in the 18th century and the Napoleonic Wars, from the perspective of Orkney, which is a very, very interesting perspective to provide. But it's not just that. It's also about everything that makes a particular place in the world distinctive. it's an island that has played a pivotal role in kind of medieval history and then becomes the kind of the archetype of an out of the way place. But obviously for people who live there, it's not out of the way at all. They live there.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant, brilliant work. And it makes you think not just about the specifics of, you know, a particular place, but about the whole way that history is written.
Oh, Tom, that sounds brilliant.
Yeah. And it's often very dryly funny as well.
Yeah. His book, is it Heretics and Reformers?
Heretics and Believers, I think.
I read that 2 or 3 years ago, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant when I was writing my Six Wives.
Well, he wrote a brilliant book on Luther, which quite an influence on the series that we did,
right,
about how the idea of the Reformation was kind of invented in the wake of the Nailing of the Theses, and how the Nailing of the Theses came to be the iconic episode that it did.
Right.
And he wrote, I think, the single best volume on the English Reformation.
Yeah, definitely.
But he's actually Orcadian. He's from Orkney.
That I did not know.
So that was a treat. I mean, you know when you go somewhere and the book you're reading is in perfect synthesis with the place that you're at.
Yeah, yeah.
And even better, it's, you know, you haven't pre-prepared for success. It's just been delivered to you. It's pure serendipity. So it was a very, you know, one of those kind of very, very intense reading pleasures that you always remember. So that was great.
So Tom, you say it was the best history book you've read this year, but the year is not out.
No.
And actually the best history book that you read this year was probably finished. Well, was finished in the last couple of weeks. And that of course is Adventures in Time, Nelson, Hero of the Seas.
I can't wait for that, I have to say. When is that out?
So they've changed the date again, Tom. So it's now out in October.
In time for Trafalgar Day.
We're actually in time for Christmas, I believe, is there?
But I hope they're publishing it on Trafalgar Day.
I don't think the marketing department care about Trafalgar Day, but they do care about Christmas. So I loved writing that. It was your idea. If we end up doing podcasts about Nelson, I will say this again, but just let me say it now for the members of the Rest is History Club. I owe you massively for that, because you said, don't do it on Napoleon, do it on Nelson.
I'm here to serve, Dominic.
And he is such a great subject for a kid's book.
I look forward to your dedication.
Oh, well. Yeah, you may be surprised, Tom. You may be surprised.
Yeah, who knows? So an Orcadian link, apparently an Orcadian sailor helped Nelson down to the deck after he'd been shot at Trafalgar.
Really?
And then when Napoleon went on board Bellerophon,
yeah,
he got befriended by an Orcadian sailor. So it's just kind of fun things that all these, you know, these great events, and there's always an Orcadian popping up at some point.
So on the Napoleon front, let me tell you something else that I did while you were away. I watched Napoleon, or rather, I watched about the first 7 minutes, then I gave up.
The Ridley Scott?
Yeah, terrible. Couldn't believe it.
Why did you give up?
Awful. And that actually, what made it so awful, Theo is just writing, it's terrible, so bad in the chat, and he's not wrong. I just found Joaquin Phoenix absolutely unwatchable and ridiculous.
Oh, I thought he was good.
I thought it was like something from a bit of Fry and Laurie sketch or something.
Yeah.
They say his brother, speaking with an English accent, says, and here is my younger brother, Napoleon. Who can say if we get too long for you? And the camera pans across, and there is a man who's palpably 20 years older than his older brother, but also speaking with a totally different accent.
I know.
And not even vaguely pretending to be Corsican. I mean, oh, laughable.
I was told, go and watch it and assume it's a comedy.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it hugely as a result of that. And I bet you still haven't seen, talking of films that open with Marie Antoinette being guillotined, I bet you still haven't seen the Chilean one with the vampire. Have you?
No, I haven't. No.
Pinochet.
Should watch that.
Yeah.
That's Margaret Thatcher, isn't it?
Oh, you've given away the twist.
Yeah, but Tom, we've already talked about it.
Oh, have we? I can't remember. Yeah.
I'll tell you something else that I saw that I think you would love. It's a film called The Holdovers with Paul Giamatti.
Oh, yeah.
Where he plays a classics teacher at an American boarding school. And I think you'd very much enjoy that film, Tom.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll watch that.
Because he's all about references to Carthage and Rome and stuff. It's very funny. It's very moving.
Oh, we love that. Yeah.
Set in the 70s.
Okay, well, excellent.
Right, let's answer some questions, shall we?
Yes.
Theo will want us to remind everybody where we are. So last week, we had Moonwalkers with Tom Hanks and then Disco.
Can you believe we had Tom Hanks? It still seems weird to me.
Yeah, such a strange thing to have said.
People keep saying to me, friends, I can't believe you had Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And I kind of become mentally adjusted to it. And then I pause and think, yeah, that is just so odd.
It's also odd that he did it in such a jolly way, isn't it?
Well, by the end, the jokes were coming fast and furious, weren't they?
Oh, the bants.
Your great Zendaya joke.
Yeah. Tom, I'm so proud of that. I think that's the best thing I've ever said on the Rest is History.
I know. I think it might be Do you think it's possibly the greatest joke ever made on the rest of history?
It's got to be.
It's got to be up there, hasn't it?
I know I'm saying it about my own joke.
It pains me to admit it, but...
What I really am hoping is that she'll do it. That word will reach her. That she seems like an amusing person. Yeah. That she would appreciate the irony of appearing on a podcast with Tom Holland.
Yeah.
And that she'll maybe bone up. I mean, you know, Theo can send her some notes. I just want to have her there talking about the Battle of Sedan or something.
Well, and you know, the other thing, of course, the other Hollywood themed guest that we need is Russell Crowe for Russell Crowe Week, which we're going to be doing.
Yeah, we do. So if any of you out there, Julia Gillard, if you're listening, you know, if you have contacts with Russell Crowe, please, we really want Russell Crowe on the podcast. I mean, that's basically my dream.
Yeah, because we're doing Gladiator, Master and Commander, and Les Miserables.
Is that the plan?
Yeah, those three.
Not Robin Hood.
No, I don't think we'll do Robin Hood.
Yeah, slightly dodgy at ground.
No, I mean, they're all brilliant. Everything Russell Crowe has done is brilliant.
Of course, of course.
Just absolutely putting that on the record. But I think those three are the...
Yeah, that's the canon. That's the canon.
That's the canon.
Yeah. Let's do some questions, Tom.
No, because we still haven't said what we're doing. So we've got Byron at the moment. And then when that finishes, we're doing The First Emperor of China.
Yeah.
Which I'm massively working on at the moment. And then tailoring.
Yeah, that's fun. Do you know, I often think about this because I've been reading this man on Twitter called Derek Guy. Do you ever see him, Tom?
No.
He's the guy who analyzes men's suits and says, oh, this is too short, this is too tight.
Ooh, suits you, that kind of stuff.
Do you know the man who he thinks is the best dressed person in the world? The King of Spain.
Oh, not our king. The King of Spain. Yeah, he is well-dressed.
The King of Spain is phenomenally well-dressed.
Yes. He's a natty dresser.
And so this guy will post very detailed analyses.
But isn't King Charles also widely rated?
Yes, he is. He is. And because what both of those men have done is they've not followed the trend to have unnecessarily short jackets and trousers too slim.
So that is something that Rishi Sunak could learn from.
Rishi Sunak, you see, he's got it all wrong.
He really has.
Rishi Sunak makes himself look even shorter than he is.
I know.
Because he looks like a boy at school whose parents have neglected to buy this year's uniform.
Because isn't the essence of tailoring that it's got to look timeless? Timeless classic.
Yeah. I think that's probably true. Although the interesting thing, of course, we'll talk about this in the episode, is that obviously wasn't the vibe when it started, right? When the look was laid down.
By Brummel.
The look's obviously partly derived from military fashions in the Napoleonic Wars. But that's not a timeless look. That's a new look.
Yeah, well, it is then. But then, well, listen, we'll discuss all this.
Yes.
And then we've got Little Bighorn, haven't we?
Yeah.
Custer.
Crazy Horse, Custer, Sitting Bull, and hopefully, yet to be discussed, but hopefully finishing off with the Ghost Dance. So loads and loads to talk about there. And actually, Tom, am I right in thinking that you're doing a little bit of reading on matters Scottish?
Yes. So we are planning. We scheduled two episodes, didn't we, on Bonnie Prince Charlie?
Yeah.
And having read a couple of very entertaining books on Bonnie Prince Charlie and the 45, I don't think we're going to do it in two episodes.
Yeah.
He is a comical character.
Oh, good. We love a comical Scotsman on The Rest Is History.
Well, he's not Scottish, though, is he?
No, a Frenchman, effectively.
Well, apparently, he basically grew up not speaking any language fluently at all.
Really? He's a citizen of nowhere.
So he could speak English, French, Italian, and Latin badly.
Crikey.
But he never really learned to speak any of them like a native.
Tom is the ultimate Remainer, isn't he?
Yes. Citizen of everywhere.
Yeah.
So all that to come. Anyway, listen, let's get on. So should we go back to the moon landings? We've just had one question here.
Yeah.
So this is from Reticus, very much a friend of the Discord question community. For Americans of a certain age, the moon landing is a major triumph, symbolic of American scientific achievement and strength at a time when confidence was faltering. Has this event lost impact in recent decades, and do you think it will stand as a major event in human history or as more of a footnote?
Great question.
Well, there are two questions there, aren't there? Because has it lost its impact in recent decades is not quite the same as saying, was it a major event in human history?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So let's take the major event. Definitely a major event, Tom. Do you not think?
Well, we did the seven great iconic episodes in human history, didn't we? And this was one of them.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't change anybody's life. So if you're talking about, you know, does it change people's lives as much as penicillin or Operation Barbarossa? No. But on the other hand, the great events often stand for something bigger than themselves. So this is the ultimate event that stands for mankind's ability to manipulate his environment.
The final frontier.
Yeah, I mean, all that kind of stuff. Exactly, exactly.
All that, yeah.
So I think we're probably agreed on that, aren't we? That the symbolism of it is extraordinary.
Yes. And I would say that photo of Neil Armstrong on the moon,
yeah,
will be probably the image in 1,000 or 2,000 years' time by which the 20th century will be remembered, if we're still around.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's probably fair. Because although people would say, the world wars, there will presumably be lots more world wars.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who remembers the Punic Wars?
Yeah. Now, has it lost its impact? So funnily enough, I still personally find it quite moving. I find it weirdly moving. I don't know why I find it moving, because actually, you know, I'm not massively invested in science. But when I see, you know, footage of the men walking on the moon and the crowds watching TVs and stuff, I always find it really rousing. So personally, I find it does have an impact. But I think socially, more broadly, it definitely has lost its impact, because it feels like a relic of the 60s, a relic of the optimism of the 60s. And I think there's a sort of negativity now among younger people, which is, you know, oh, life is harder than it used to be. Oh, you know, the baby boomers are terrible people, all that kind of stuff. And I think maybe the moon landing's tarnished a bit by that, a sense that it's an indulgent sort of tangent.
Yeah. I thought also, I mean, it's like everything else, it's become embroiled in Americans' culture wars.
Yeah.
So I saw First Man.
Oh, yes.
When we were preparing for the Tom Hanks episode. And it's very much about white military men. And there's no real way around that.
Yeah.
I mean, they chuck in some wives to provide a bit of feminine content. But basically, it's men going out there boldly. And as the rocket is going up, on the other side, they have people watching it and protesting against it as a kind of, you know, waste of money.
Yeah.
And they have Gil Scott-Heron's song, Whitey on the Moon, which was a kind of protest song written at the time. You know, why is money being spent on this when there are people suffering in the ghettos or whatever?
Mm.
And I don't think that would have been included if it had been made in the 90s, perhaps.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think the sense of it as an unadulterated American triumph has become complicated.
Mm.
And of course, there is also the fact that it, you know, it was part of the Cold War dynamic.
Yeah.
And so we can see that more clearly now, perhaps, that the sense of a superpower rivalry is coming back, that China is aiming to put people on the moon and that India has been sending landers and all kinds of things like that.
Yeah.
But I still think that in time, when the geopolitics of it fades, that photo, that image will remain. And so actually, the rhetoric of Kennedy that America is going there for the whole of humanity will be fulfilled.
Yeah.
It will be remembered even if people don't remember what the United States was.
Yeah, totally agree with you. I completely agree with you on that, Tom. By the way, small thing, I don't want to get too political, but it's a weird thing now that when people say, and a product, of course, of the Cold War, there's a sort of implied censorious to that. Like, the Cold War was a terrible thing and America should have been ashamed for competing in the Cold War. Do you not think that's...
No, I don't think... I think it's, again, to go back to Star Trek.
Yeah.
Star Trek is, you know, United Federation of Planets, and it ends up with a Russian on the bridge with, you know, with the Americans, or Canadians in the case of Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
But Star Trek is obviously a very American sense of universal human values. And I think that the reminder that the talk, you know, the rhetoric of, you know, one big step for mankind and all that kind of thing, it's just saying, well, yeah, fine. But it is also expressive of geopolitical rivalries. I mean, America's claiming to be representative of humanity is itself a very, very political statement in the context of a superpower rivalry, don't you think?
It is, Tom, but I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I don't have a problem with the fact that America was fighting the Cold War ideologically and that it equated its values with universal human values. And I think that's fine. That's what empires do. I don't have a problem with them doing that.
It is, but I think equally that if the rhetoric is universalist,
yeah,
it is sometimes worthwhile pointing out that universalist rhetoric can itself be very chauvinist.
Yes, of course. Agreed. I completely agree with that. But I think there's a slight tendency, and it's actually been there for as long as I've been a historian, to say, but very American, of course, as though, okay, that completely undermines the whole enterprise, because that means, you know, oh, it's on a slippery slope that leads to George W. Bush or something. No. I think that tendency is there, particularly in academia. Do you not think?
Yeah, maybe. But I think that both things are true. And that's why it's such an amazing theme and why I hope that we'll go back and do it, is that it is expressive of America's desire to win the Cold War and to, you know, surpass the Soviet Union's initial lead in the space race, while simultaneously being expressive of something profound about the human race. I mean, both are true. And the tension between those two is what makes it such a brilliant, brilliant story.
Yeah, both are totally true. Yeah. All right. Fine. Agreed.
Oh, and here's another question, which everyone has been asking while we've been away.
Yeah.
So this is from Callum the Young Chevalier. So this is a news story that broke, I think, last week.
It did.
And Callum refers to it. With the recent news story that Harold Wilson was having an affair with someone who wasn't Marcia Williams, were you surprised? Does it matter or is it just a bit prurient? Lord Donoghue is quoted, "I felt as a sometime historian, this was important to go in the historical record of Wilson." So this is Harold Wilson, Prime Minister in 1974, and very much the hero, I think, of the four-part series we did on that a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
In which the focus was very much on his relationship with Marcia Williams, this kind of dominatrix style.
Mm, tapping a handbag and saying, one phone call to the Daily Mail and he'll be finished. I will destroy him.
Yeah.
So, Tom, yes, I got a lot of calls about this when I was obviously busy finishing my Nelson book. So, this is such an interesting story, and I know we can't go on about this all day, but her name had already been linked to Wilson, so it's not a total bolt from the blue. So, in about 1994, when Ben Pimlott published his biography on Wilson, which, by the way, is the best biography of Wilson, and is probably going to remain so because it's very hard to imagine any publisher will ever pay anyone money to write another biography of Harold Wilson, because frankly, who cares? In that, he says, Wilson got very close to this younger civil servant. People gossiped and joked that he had a crush on her. You know, there was a lot of talk behind the scenes. And then that paragraph just sort of ends, and then he cracks back on with economic policy or something, and it's forgotten. So actually, when I was writing my own book on the 70s, I'd obviously read that, but I thought, well, that doesn't really go anywhere. And the other thing that's interesting is, so the diaries, particularly Lord Donoghue's diaries, which are is amazing, amazing insight into the world behind the scenes in Number 10. So much of our podcast series came from those diaries. They don't really mention her massively. The other big diarists of the period, like Tony Benn, don't mention her particularly. There's no sort of sense that she has an outsized role in Number 10. So I didn't think of pursuing it, really. Anyway, the story has now come out that she and Wilson were having a relationship. This story is based on one person, which is Joe Haynes. Joe Haynes is now
120.
Yeah, incredibly old, but has still not lost his ability to kind of stir up. You know, he's a press secretary, he's a former press man. Every sort of 6 months in the last few years, he would write an article in the Daily Mail in which you would say Jeremy Corbyn was the worst man who'd ever lived or something, and get everybody very excited, insofar as people are excited about what somebody from the 1970s thinks. So Haynes now says, okay, they had this relationship. I've been sitting on this all this time. Bernard Donoghue, his friend, says, I knew this too. And it's really important to correct the historical record, and it changes how we think. It's very important for political historians. I think it is kind of mildly interesting in a purely voyeuristic way, but I don't think it changes anything at all. I don't think it makes the slightest difference. It's a bit like, imagine that you discovered something comes up in Pompeii that shows that Augustus, for 5 years, was sleeping with one of his, you know, slave girls or the wife of some Roman aristocrat.
I'm sure he was.
Well, that's exactly the thing, right? You'd be like, it's a nice new detail, but it doesn't change the story of his supremacy over Rome. And I think in the same way, the fact that Harold Wilson, for an hour a night or whatever it was kind of bunking off to be with this civil servant, so what?
So I've got a question.
Yeah.
Which is not because I'm voyeuristic or prurient. It's because I'm interested in the workings of the Wilson government at a stressful time in the country's history. And that's the only reason I'm asking this.
Right.
Does this have any implications for his relationship with Marcia?
Good question. And yes and no is the answer. So obviously Marcia is still the more important relationship there in terms of the effect on policy. So Janet Hewlett Davis is a fairly junior civil servant. The Haynes and Donoghue line is, oh, she gave Wilson great comfort. A little bit of sunlight at sunset or something, which some more feminist critics picked up on and thought was outrageous. And people said, what about his wife? This is very poor behavior. Anyway, the picture that we have of Wilson that emerges from their accounts above all, actually, is of somebody who is exhausted, miserable, distracted by faction fighting. I don't feel like this changes that. There's no sense from any other sources that he's kind of you know, the cat that's got the cream. He's having a brilliant time. He's got this new lover in his life.
He's not the Lord Byron of prime ministers.
No, he's not. So this doesn't change that. And the relationship with Marcia is clearly politically the more important. And it obviously doesn't ease things. She must have been aware of it in some way or aware that something was going on. But the fact is that she was already very, you know, she's shouting at him and treating him like dirt and calling him extraordinary names even before he starts this relationship with Janet Hewlett-Davis. So I don't think it necessarily changes that, maybe exacerbates it.
But it might provide context for her general feeling of impatience with him.
Agreed.
You know, if she feels that her authority as a political manager is under threat and kind of her erotic hold over him.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
I think that's absolutely right. From a younger woman. I think that's right, Tom. I think, interestingly, in the same interview on the Today programme, Radio 4's Today programme, so that's for those people who aren't British, that's the sort of flagship talk radio programme in Britain to talk about politics. The interviewer asked Lord Donoghue about him plotting to murder Marcia. And, you know, he made a joke about it and he sort of said, oh, yeah, well, we talked about plotting to murder. We didn't actually plot to murder or something. But, he, you know, he kind of, the two are linked. So maybe Marcia is becoming, as the summer of 1974 wears on, she's becoming worse and worse because she's now so agitated and insecure because she knows Wilson is carrying on with this younger civil servant. And maybe it's at that point that they then say, well, okay, well, we'll kill her and that will clear the way for Janet or whatever. I mean, it's a mad state of affairs, but actually this one detail does not change the overriding narrative. So lots of people are saying, oh, you'll have to re-record those episodes. Oh, you'll have to rewrite your book.
Yeah.
But actually you don't. The story is still the same, just has an extra character in it, I suppose.
Okay. So we've mentioned Harold Wilson and Lord Byron, both notorious British love rats.
Yeah.
And there's a question from Steve Marasich.
Yeah.
Can you tell me the difference between a cad, a rotter, and a bounder, which is worse? And Rinker's Revenge then replied that he or she thought they were the same thing. But here is a definition from a reader of The Independent in 1994. And this is in connection with James Hewitt, another bounder.
Or cad.
Yes, or cad. Today's leading article about James Hewitt, who is supposed to, I mean, did definitely, right?
Carry on with Princess Diana.
Have an affair with Princess Diana. Misses the essential difference between a cad and a bounder. It was explained to me during my national service that a bounder was the sort of officer who would sleep with a brother officer's wife, but might then go out and win a VC, whereas a cad would sleep with the lady while his brother officer was out winning a VC. That's very good.
Okay. So, yes, I would say a cad is worse than a bounder. Wouldn't you? A cad will deceive you.
Yes, would seduce an impressionable maiden aunt and steal all her inheritance.
Yeah. Where a bounder would just seduce her.
Yeah.
Do you think? I think a bounder is ultimately an amusing figure rather than malevolent.
A bounder is Terry Thomas. I say, ha ha.
Yeah, a bounder is a man with an eye for the ladies, wearing a very loud tweed jacket.
Hello. Yes.
A cad destroys people's lives.
A more sinister figure.
Yeah, is a homebreaker.
Yeah.
Whereas a bounder, the end of the film, everybody's had a brilliant time with a bounder.
And a rotter, I mean, a rotter behaves badly in ways that aren't necessarily sexual.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. That's an interesting question. So are bounder and cad effectively sexual categories?
I mean, a bounder and a cad, I think generally there is a hint of misbehavior on the sexual front.
Definitely. Definitely, yes.
With a rotter, you just behave very badly. A rotter is someone who, you know, could nick the pension fund.
So let's narrow it down, Tom. Boris Johnson.
Is a bounder.
Is he a bounder? He's not a rotter.
No, I don't think he's a rotter.
He's not a cad because he's too shambolic to be a cad, right? A cad,
yeah.
I think, is quite well turned out.
I think he's a bounder. A cad, I mean, we don't want to get ourselves sued, do we?
Can you be sued? I mean, it depends who you're going to mention next. I mean, if it's Theo.
No. A rotter would be someone who just behaves very, very badly across the spectrum.
Yeah, agreed.
I say Jeremy Thorpe was a rotter. As well as a bounder. He's a bounder.
See, I'd say he was a cad.
No, I don't think he was a cad because he was... I don't think he was a cad because he didn't go out to ruin...
No, maybe not. No, he's a bounder. You're right, he's a bounder. He's too amusing to be a cad.
But he's a rotter because he agrees to murder.
Is he a rotter? I don't think he's a rotter. I don't think up to that point he'd been a rotter. Lord Byron, Tom.
Yes.
What's he?
I think as an aristocrat, he is above these.
Oh, Tom.
I think these are middle class categories.
Because one assumes that an aristocrat will behave badly anyway.
An aristocrat is not bound by these hide-bound bourgeois. Yeah.
You think there's a hint of the neck curtain about these categories?
A little bit. A little bit.
All right.
Can we just give one shout out to James von Shetland?
Sure, let's do that.
Who has just got engaged.
Oh, isn't that nice? Congratulations.
So he is a very active participant on the Discord, and he organises all the smackdowns there.
Right. So a key member of the chat community.
So that's wonderful news.
That's lovely. Congratulations, James. So to come, we have the rest of Lord Byron. If you haven't listened to that, we have the First Emperor of China. We have Tailoring. We have then our epic series about Custer, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, The Little Big Horn, and so on and so forth. And then lots of other cool things to come after that, Tom.
Yeah.
So on that bombshell, you better go and do your thing. And we'll see you all next time. Bye.